you. Been sitting there beaming and wondering what was flying past my ears. Turned out to be Maimonides, of all people. I'll have to check that out. Now, my friend Dan Bell has probably made up 100 quotations from the Talmud, which have since been repeated endlessly, all invented by him. First of all, I want to apologize in advance if any of the things I say about philanthropy should in any way offend any of the institutions represented here who have supported my endeavors in the past or are likely to do so in the future. The others can shift for themselves, but some of my best friends are what Dwight MacDonald once called philanthropoids. I have no intention of discussing charity, which is a personal and individual thing, except to point out how difficult it becomes in our society. I think it was Bill Buckley years ago who said, we live in a society in which it is regarded as wrong to take money from your family, but right to take it from the government. Used to be the other way around. It used to be regarded as wrong to take it from strangers and right to take it from your family. But private charity is another matter left to the clerics and the rabbis, if they're still around and are interested in that rather than other matters. And I'll elaborate on my theme, which is no good deed goes unpunished. And it's about philanthropy today, organized philanthropy. One of the glories of the American democracy, we read that everywhere. You can't read any discussion of philanthropy without beginning with Tocqueville and how important private associations are in our democracy, what a crucial role they play in providing our society with important needs, satisfying important needs that otherwise might have to be satisfied by government. And it's all nonsense. We live in the paradoxical situation that the nonprofit sector, which was supposed to be one of the glories of American democracy, a decentralizing factor in our society, one that prevented the growth of large government, that this nonprofit sector today is either an appendage of big government or has made a commitment to the growth of big government. Things work out in a paradoxical way in history. We have moved from the philanthropy of Andrew Carnegie to the philanthropy of the MacArthur Foundation, from the philanthropy which aimed to put people on their feet by making them less dependent through public libraries, education for people who wanted to be educated, which is what public libraries do, to a whole network now of private associations which aim to aggrandize government, weaken the economic system which created the original fortunes on which these foundations were based, and in general does everything it can to subvert the political, social, and economic system which created this philanthropic sector. It is, I submit, a sad paradox, but it is a paradox and it is a fact. It is a fact that, actually, when I gave that title, No Good Deed Goes Unpunished, I was brooding over what's happening to the universities today, having read what Duke was doing, having read what Stanford was doing. I'll return to that in a few moments. But the truth is that the great tradition of American private philanthropy over the past 100 years has really turned into something else. and that aside from the few foundations, which I mentioned at the outset, much of what we call the non-for-profit sector in this country today is devoted to subverting the profit sector and supporting and extending the political sector, when, of course, the original intention of philanthropy was exactly the opposite. This is not a passing phenomenon. At the moment, I don't see how it can be reversed, but being by nature an optimist, I have to assume at some point, if we work hard enough, we can somehow reverse it. At least, I think one has to proceed on that assumption. But the fact remains that what we call philanthropy today, and not only philanthropy, but private nonprofit associations, including a great many of our churches, really are playing a role absolutely opposite to the role that they traditionally played in our society and that they were supposed to play in our society, according to Tocqueville and according to others. Let me give you a couple of little clippings I picked up. One is, involves my own university, law school. NYU Law School has just received $2 million for a study on law and philanthropy. Well, now, NYU is not so bad. It's not Harvard. I mean, the law school. I mean, it's flaky liberal, not flaky left. But still, you know what kind of legal recommendations are going to come out of that, those studies. I mean, you can be certain that they're going to want to have the boards of all foundations, constituted so as to take into account race, class, gender, which is the new holy trinity of American society, and all sorts of other nice little legal requirements which will simply confirm the prejudices of those people who, in fact, today run most of the major foundations. So I just wanted to warn you, those studies will be coming out sometime over the next 2 or 3 years. Fortunately, it's only $2 million, and that doesn't support many studies at NYU. The other is really much more interesting. It's from the Washington Post of last week, and it involves a foundation that I never heard of, established by a Mr. William M. Burke. I don't know who Mr. William M. Burke is. And this is what he does. Every year, 250 students are brought to Washington from colleges and universities all over the country and serve 3 month internships in congressional legislation, communications, and science, mainly with advocacy groups. They receive a $1,000 stipend each. So we're talking about a basic expenditure of at least $500,000 a year. And what I love is the wording of the Washington Post story. These students are part of a growing number of students who add to the standard experiences represented by a college degree by leaving campus to participate in the activism of professional altruism. Professional altruism. That's, in fact, what a great deal, I mean, that's what a lot of foundations are involved in. Which, professional altruism, you understand, is another way of saying politics. But nevertheless, these young people can get a sense that they are not simply being involved in politics. They are being professional altruists. There's another item I have here, but I'm saving that for later, which is even funnier. So I think I don't want to read any more quotes by Tocqueville on the importance of private associations in sustaining American democracy. So far as I can see, most of the private associations of this country are busy undermining American democracy. And I wonder really how much worse off we would all be if they didn't exist. I mean, I would be worse off, I assure you. Not personally, but in terms of the things I do. But still, they'd be much worse off. They. I need not define them. And I look at England, and I look at France, and I look at Germany, nations which do not have our tradition of professional altruism, which in fact do not have the tax laws or other legislation which makes it possible. And no tax deductibility for most of the gifts, or at least very little. And I look at their experience, and I look at our experience, and I ask myself, are they so much worse off than we are? Are we really better off for having the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the et cetera, et cetera, MacArthur? I mean, I can go down the list. And what is worse is that the number of those foundations are growing. The number of our foundations, traditional foundations, may not be shrinking, but they're not growing very fast. Things don't always work out as they are supposed to work out. And one of the things I want to suggest is perhaps you ought to think over this whole issue of philanthropy and think about the whole question of the legal status of philanthropy and stop quoting Tocqueville and really take a hard look as to how things have actually worked out and stop thinking that this, which in fact was one of the glories of American democracy, Andrew Carnegie was a great man, whether in fact it long ago ceased being one of the glories of our democracy and became one of the great problems of our democracy. As I say, history creates paradoxes, confronts us with the unexpected, and our thinking is always lagging behind. I'll give you another instance along the similar lines, which I've been thinking about recently, watching what happens in Washington or what happens in the country, which is the whole question of federalism and the devolution of authority. All conservatives have always been federalists, have always been in favor of, to the maximum degree, devolving upon local governments as much of the problems of government as is feasible. I'm beginning to wonder whether or not this is so, whether or not this makes conservative sense. It's interesting that in Britain, Margaret Thatcher, and by the way, the British thinking among conservatives is exactly the same as American, traditionally. But Margaret Thatcher finally decided that if she was going to do anything about British education, she had to centralize, not federalize. That, in fact, the federalization of British education meant the domination of huge school districts by Marxists, left-wing, trendy types of one kind or another, who, in fact, have just simply taken over the school system and have accomplished what Mao called the march through the institutions, or maybe it was Gramsci who used that phrase originally. Now, this is not quite the case in the United States today, but it's not far from being the case. Fact is that, like everyone else here, I suppose, 8 years ago, I was all for abolishing the Department of Education. I must say, after watching what has been going on these past 8 years, I think one of the best things about American education today is the Department of Education under its current leadership. And without that kind of critique from on high, who knows what would be going on in American education? Lord knows we know what's going on in American education. The fact is that contrary to our presuppositions and contrary to our older historical experience, does not follow that local government is the most responsible government. Local government very frequently turns out to be the more irresponsible government as compared with central government. Local government turns out to be, oddly enough, that government where conservative impulses and conservative ideas are likely to have less effect than on central government. We are far more likely to win the presidency of the United States than to elect a mayor in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and about 10 other major American cities. And the educational systems in those major population centers reflect the political dominance that is the case there. Mind you, I still would like to see the national... My wife is a member of the council of the NEH, so I cannot speak for her. She'll have to speak for herself. But let me put it this way. I don't foresee any troublesome quarrels at home when I say I would like to see the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts abolished. Though, I must tell you, I mean, they do very little good. I was a member of the Council of the National Endowment for the Humanities for about 5 years. I spent all of my time trying to persuade everyone on the council of the virtues of archaeology. I wanted to spend zillions of dollars on archaeology and very little on anything else. I wasn't entirely successful. But I will also say this. If you think the National Endowment for the Humanities or the National Endowment for the Arts is bad, you should see the state councils. I mean, we, and that was basically, even under Ron Berman, a liberal-dominated institution. Staff was all liberal. We had to control and rein in the state councils on the humanities and the arts because they were going off into outer space. So the thought that, no, the closer you are, the smaller the unit, the closer you are theoretically to the people, the more responsible you're likely to be, in our society doesn't seem to really work for various reasons having to do with circumstances. As Edmund Burke said, circumstances in the end color and shape everything. No point. You need a political philosophy. I would say these days you need something that can be called a political ideology. But in the end, it's circumstances, reality, that you have to adapt to. And the circumstances that face this country today is that conservatives are best at winning national elections, worst at winning local elections, and even still worse at controlling local institutions, whether they be school boards, churches, anything except maybe the Elks. I mean, I don't know very much about the Elks, but we are losing, and over the years have lost control over most of these local institutions. Every now and then at the national level, we can exercise some control. Now, what follows from this, I must tell you, I don't know. All I do know is that our thinking is not quite up to date in its assumptions. Now, let me say a few words about conservative philanthropy, which is of very great importance. I've been watching the operation of institutions supported by conservative philanthropy now for about 20 years. I participated. And the crucial role they play is this, in creating disillusionment among radical and liberal thinkers. It's a very important role. Very important role to show that other people's ideas don't work or are based on fallacious assumptions, which is pretty much the same thing, or that the conclusions do not follow logically from the evidence. This has been especially true in the social sciences. I mean, my own magazine, The Public Interest, I think has been very successful over 23 years in really creating hurdles for liberal and left-wing social science by simply criticizing cogently their thinking, their research, their conclusions, and then they have to leap over those hurdles, and sometimes they can't. Sometimes they can try to run around them. That would be the usual strategy. But the fact is, conservative philanthropy, insofar as it's in the world that I'm familiar with and involved in, the world of ideas, the world of what we call the war of ideas, has played a crucial role in defending, well, how should I put it, defending traditional common sense against the onslaughts of social science. I think that puts it very fairly. And I think this is what basically is happening at the American Enterprise Institute, at the Heritage Foundation, at the Cato Institute, at practically all of the institutions supported by conservative foundations, regardless of the differences between them. On the other hand, this is a defensive posture and a defensive battle. And if you, in prize fighting or in football, I mean, if you are continually on the defense, you have to be very, very lucky to win. I mean, the other guy really just has to fumble more than once and badly if you are going to win. Because usually if you are skillful on the defense but have no offense, have no program of your own in this case, you will end up losing, which is pretty much what is happening. And this is, I must say, dispiriting. It's not the foundation's fault. Foundations are there. They want us all to come up with positive ideas and positive programs that will create enthusiasm among young people, generate popular support. But it has been very, very difficult. And we have been only minimally successful. And I think we ought to be aware of the fact. I think we ought to be aware of the fact that for 20, at least in my own experience, a quarter of a century at least, we have been fighting rather successfully a defensive war. And the trouble with fighting the defensive war is that you repel the invaders. They go back and regroup. You know, they'll have a new strategy. Suddenly you find that you have to study a whole new area that they have come up with. They're very clever people, very hardworking people. And they know what they're doing, which is to march through the institutions. And they are doing that. And we keep puncturing their thinking and their philosophy. We keep pointing out their fallacies, and they're the ones who keep getting tenure in the colleges and who end up dominating, as they do now, as never before in American history, American higher education and, to a much lesser degree, American secondary education. Why can't we do better? That's the question I want to raise. And if anyone has any ideas, I'd be delighted to get a letter and try to learn from it, because we're spending actually not very much money. There aren't that many conservative foundations. They're not that rich. But even so, I have a feeling that while we continue this defensive battle, it's not enough. We cannot generate enough enduring enthusiasm unless we come up with some more positive answers to the questions that our society poses. And these are serious questions. I think the one area where we could have done better and still have the opportunity to do better is in American thinking about foreign policy. Corporate philanthropy, which I also happen to be familiar, basically not very much interested in foreign policy. I mean, they're all good patriotic Americans, but they're businessmen and they like trading abroad. And even if you're in the defense industry, you might want to sell things to the Russians, or this or that. In any case, it is no accident that isolationism has always been so strong within the Republican Party. It reflects the importance of the business community within the Republican Party, because businessmen are not political animals. And to have a coherent professional view in a foreign policy, you really have to be a political animal, because that's what foreign policy is about. It's not about economics. It's not about business. It's about power. I think some of the private foundations have been very supportive of the area farm policy. But the fact is, we really haven't done as well as we should have in this whole area. We have not yet. The reason it's so important is this. When you have a foreign policy, and when you have foreign policy leadership based on certain ideas that are put into practice, you unite the people. Theodore Roosevelt understood that. He even said this. And he had the nerve to say this in a message to Congress, saying foreign policy unites the various classes of Americans as nothing else can do. Foreign policy is a inherently, should be a very conservative enterprise, one that conservatives should have a very special interest in, because if anything is going to save this democracy, it's foreign policy, not by defending us against the Russians, but by mobilizing the spirit of patriotism and even of nationalism among the American people. You can talk all you want about traditional values and how important they are. There's nothing like a war, if I may say so, to inspire a respect for traditional values. There is nothing like a foreign policy crisis to rally the people around the nation's political traditions. So we have a stake, we conservatives, in having a foreign policy suitable to a great power that mobilizes the people of this country, which is why I have been involved in trying to develop something called a unilateral American foreign policy, so our hands won't be tied by all of our allies and all of those international organizations, and so we won't. We're facing the insane problem we have in Panama. You watch congressmen get up on television and say we ought to consult with our allies in Latin America. We have no allies in Latin America. It's ridiculous. I never have had any. But if we had the right kind of presidential leadership, which I thought we might get under Ronald Reagan, did not quite. Got a bit of it here and there, but not consistently so. On the other hand, be fair to Ronald Reagan, you can't get the right presidential leadership unless you have the ideas floating around, legitimated, that he can appeal to as making sense. I think conservatives and conservative foundations should be paying a lot more attention to foreign policy. And by foreign policy, I don't mean INF or any of that stuff. I mean, I'm a heretic in all sorts of areas of foreign policy. I'm even anti-nuclear. I don't believe in the first use of nuclear weapons. By foreign policy, I mean figuring out a foreign policy that galvanizes the people into thinking well of their country, into supporting their country, into being ready to fight and die for their country. Once you're ready to fight and die for your country, you stop questioning its political traditions or its moral traditions. You think well of your country when you're usually. It's an instinctive attitude. Not that I'm urging us to get into war. I'm just saying, I mean, let's not try so hard to avoid a few little foreign interventions. We need them as a democracy. We need them. This is our area, and the left understands that. The left today is not isolationist by accident. Democratic Party is not isolationist by accident. They understand that when Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada, which no one had ever heard of before, and couldn't locate on a map, something happened to the American people. This was a great conservative moment. It vanished. That is, it was allowed to leak away. But if we had had a more consistent foreign policy and more consistent thinking about foreign policy, more consistent writing and publishing about foreign policy, not in terms of this thing called, quote, national security, a phrase I despise. It's an isolationist phrase. Our national security in any real sense was not affected by Grenada or the Dominican Republic under Lyndon Johnson or anything of the sort. It's an isolationist phrase. Until we can have a larger view, and this I return once again to Theodore Roosevelt, who in fact didn't invade anyone, didn't have to. Until we can develop in our thinking and in the country at large a larger view of the United States and its role in the world, a more activist view of the United States and its role in the world, we will have a problem. This is an opportunity for us. And as I say, they see it. They understand that. It's an opportunity, unfortunately, that a great many conservatives don't appreciate and don't see. This is what I mean by responding to circumstance. I mean, it's an odd thing to say, you know, why should a conservative necessarily be in favor of a somewhat more aggressive, perhaps even a bit adventurous foreign policy? That doesn't sound very conservative. But conservatism is what circumstances require it to be. And I think that under current circumstances, either we have an activist foreign policy or the country will be dominated by those specific special interests that now constitute the domestic agenda and which inevitably leads to the victory of liberalism and the left. Another problem on the agenda which we haven't addressed and which I have been led to believe is a bit controversial among some of the people here is the welfare state. I am amused to listen to conservatives debate the welfare state. Not all conservatives, obviously. Now, I'm reminded of that wonderful incident, when was it, 1954, when you had the East German workers? Arnold Beichmann, you're my authority on that. Huh?
June 17th,
1951?
Three.
I was off a year, not bad. You had the workers rising in East Germany and Bertolt Brecht living in East Berlin, a communist and a playwright and a poet, was very bitter at the suppression of the workers' rebellion. First time he was ever dissented from the Communist Party rule, and he wrote a wonderful little poem which was published in East Germany saying, you know, have to choose between the party and the people. Either we abolish the party or we abolish the people. And the government has decided to abolish the people. An awful lot of conservatives, when they look at the welfare state, have decided to abolish the people. Now, I don't much like the current welfare state. I don't much like the current people. But they are what they are, that's all. And there's no point in going around beating Americans over the head for wanting Social Security where they want it, for wanting Medicare the way they want it, for wanting this the way they want it. They want it, and they're not going to change. Points to the fact that not everyone, conservative politicians say, well, no, we're not against the welfare state. Look what we did, this, that. In almost every case, the dialectic works this way. Liberals propose an agenda on medical insurance. Conservatives say, oh, no, that's ridiculous. Debate takes place. Conservatives finally compromise. They take half of the liberal agenda, and that they get through Congress. And then conservatives say, see, we're not against the welfare state. But the people know who's really for and who's really against. And the fact is there have been very few initiatives consistent with conservative principles so far as the welfare state is concerned. And Mr. Carlson can tell you he's been one of the few thinkers, I think, who's been trying to come up with initiatives. And it's practically impossible to get the traditional kinds of conservatives to think along these lines. I mean, we had tax reform. The obvious thing to do is, if you were pro-family, and it would have solved so many problems, is to raise the exemption for children to $5,000 per child, which would have brought it up to where it had been 15 years ago, taking inflation into account. I think I'm right in that. Would have solved a lot of the current controversy over daycare centers, would have solved an awful lot of problems had the Reagan administration had the guts to do it. But the conservatives and the Treasury said, oh, it'll cost money. They're going to spend the money now on their program, not ours. And they'll get the credit. We won't. It'll cost money. It'll be this. It'll be that. There are other ways we can spend the money. They didn't understand the importance of taking the initiative on an issue of this kind. There have been almost none, I won't say none, there have been almost none, no conservative, successful conservative initiatives on the welfare state. Almost none, have been one or two. And you cannot engage in the game of American politics today that way. You've got to be attentive to the people as they are. Then you don't have the power to abolish them, and they're not going to go away. They get a little more conservative, they get a little more liberal, but the fact is they, like the people in every Western democracy, want a welfare state. You can sit and deplore it, it's all right with me. You can write, tell sad stories about the decline of republics, fine. You can deplore the lack of the death of individual initiative, okay. I'll buy all of that. But if you're in politics, it's not poetry. I mean, politics consists of winning elections and dominating public opinion. And no point in writing sad poems about the death of republics if you're in politics. Leave that to the poets. Let me return to the area I probably know best, which is the academic world. The academic world at the moment is of a condition that it's impossible to get people who are not in it to understand. And no one believes it's as bad as in fact it is. I mean, I've spoken to trustees of I don't know how many dozens of colleges, and I try to tell them how bad it is. They do not believe me. They simply cannot believe that race, class, gender is indeed the holy trinity in most of our major universities today. That faculty are chosen on the basis of race, class, gender. That ideas are chosen for study on the basis of race, class, gender. That the curriculum is chosen and shaped on the basis of race, class, gender. Proportional representation is affirmative action in the realm of ideas, in the realm of people, in the realm of everything. I mean, and now the things happen in ways people don't even notice what's going on, unless you're very attentive. A few weeks ago in the New York Times Book Review, there's a very interesting, I think it was in the New York Review of Books, a very interesting essay by the philosopher Richard Rorty, who's very thoughtful liberal man, not a wild man at all. He's going along, he's discussing philosophers. Hobbes, Locke, Montesquieu, Rousseau. And at some point, he then says, if a philosopher da-da-da-da, she will go on. There's only something, oh, well, who's the she? You know, he's just listed eight different men. He put in a she. Why? He was intimidated. That's why. He has to. If you write a book for university press these days, you have the he-she problem. Yeah. If you refer to God, you can get into trouble if you just say he. Even if you capitalize, it doesn't matter. They're willing to capitalize. They want a capitalist she. Or at least he slash she, which is the way a lot of books published by university presses do get published. And they regard this question of pronouns as of great importance. I keep telling them it's of no importance. I keep pointing out that the Turks, oddly enough, have no masculine or feminine pronouns, only one pronoun for both. And they're not exactly a sexless society or famous for, you know, for matriarchy or something. But never mind, that's the way it is in the universities today. There may be some universities in which it is not the case. I don't know of them. I don't know of them. Catholic universities, incidentally, which used to be the bulwarks of reaction, are now the worst. You go into a Catholic divinity school and read the, not in the school, go to the library. All the books are radical feminists, which is the dominant mode of thinking both in Protestant and Catholic, and to a lesser degree, much lesser degree, in Jewish seminaries today. This is a battle, I regret to say, we have lost. Forget it. You can argue with the ideas, and you should, but you can't argue inside the academy. It is hopeless. And my view is that it's important, precisely for that reason, to support the various think tanks that now exist and perhaps found others. The young conservatives, particularly if they're bright, bright young conservatives are not getting tenure in our universities, except occasionally one slips in by accident, and they won't. And it is systematic, it is intentional, and this situation gets worse every year. I keep telling, again, no use, I mean, I keep telling corporate executives, why do you give money to universities? You're wasting your time. If you want to give money to an individual professor, a remnant, a saving remnant, who's there in a particular department and one has a couple of good graduate students he needs support for, sure, that's okay. But on the whole, aside from supporting a few individuals, the battle of universities, so far as I can see, is over. Intellectuals will now exist, conservative intellectuals, in their overwhelming majority, will exist in think tanks, in journalism, in this or that freelance activity, but not in universities where they are not welcome. Maybe it'll change 20 years from now. I can tell you right now, it is absolutely hopeless. And all we can do is save a few souls here and there. It is important to still get young people through graduate school, and obviously foundations should help them, because with a PhD, they then have a certificate mad society, and everyone wants to know what degrees you have. And people call me doctor, though I can't attend to anyone. I don't even have a PhD, never went to graduate school. Nevertheless, I think it's Henry Kissinger who started this filthy habit of calling professors doctor. You know, in the old days at Harvard, you dared not call anyone a doctor. In fact, you dared not call him professor, you called him mister. As in England today, if you're a surgeon, you're called mister. If you're a doctor, you're a mere doctor. But call me mister, what can we, no point in my going around saying call me mister. In any case, the battle within the universities is pretty much over for the time being. We can intervene here, we can intervene there. It is all the more important, therefore, that the intellectual life that is occurring in conservative circles among publications, think tanks, so on, outside the universities, be supported. Because that's where conservatism has a chance to survive. And we're important. I mean, fortunately, one good thing that's happened inside the academy is that they have become very academic. And very often, these days, they write, most of the time, they write in a language that no one can understand unless they have been thoroughly initiated into that language. And that's helpful. I mean, I'm not one of those who complain about the incomprehensible language of deconstructionism or Lacanianism or so on. I think it's fine. I don't want them to be comprehensible. I want them to just go ahead and publish these books. But nevertheless, if you're going to intervene in the political debate, we need conservative publications. We need conservative think tanks. We need conservative intellectual centers. And they're not, for the most part, going to be in universities. The culture as a whole is a terrible problem about which I really don't know what to do. And about the culture as a whole, I will now read the other little clipping I got from Forbes magazine, which I read regularly. Remember, you know, Forbes magazine? Know the ad? You know, Forbes, capitalist tool? It's not a capitalist tool. Well, the magazine may be. But Malcolm Forbes himself is one high-class jerk. I'm talking about Malcolm Forbes Sr. And he doesn't know capitalism from socialism, from anything. He's a bloody fool and an influential fool, but typical fool. I mean, and what's interesting is in the latest issue, he has a discussion interview with a publisher, someone else from Forbes magazine, about business and the arts, the business committee of the arts. And he goes on how important it is for the CEO to get involved in supporting the arts, to supporting artistic enterprises, to be supportive of museums, and so on and so forth. And he has the foggiest notion of what's going on. The fact of the matter is that museums are, these days, subversive institutions, mostly. You know, I mean, not in what they show, but in the people who run them, the guiding ethos, and their role is to take conservative businessmen and who are unsophisticated for the most part and unwitting, and bring them into what Lionel Trilling called the adversary culture without knowing that that's what happened. So they all serve on the board of museums. They have nothing, the museums put on sometimes horrendous exhibits, not always, some of them are wonderful, obviously. Some of them are absolutely horrendous, but the businessmen pay no attention. They don't understand that they have been co-opted. They don't, and the museums and the symphony orchestras and the various artistic activities, it is impossible to overemphasize the significant role they play in taking perfectly good, sensible businessmen and their wives and making them part of the trendy culture of the left, which they then support most generously, not knowing what they are doing. I've seen this in the National Endowment for the Arts. I've seen this in the National, I mean, appoint a businessman to the National Endowment for the Arts, it doesn't matter how conservative he is, he ends up supporting every little left-wing group in the artistic world that you can come up with. He's intimidated. He doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't even know what he likes. And the consequence is that he gains status by participating in this, in these soirees and these parties, seeing his name in the paper, these grand receptions of the Metropolitan Museum, Museum of Modern Art. They have that, again, lock, stock, and barrel. And I honestly don't know what to do about it. What we call the adversary culture dominates not just the academy, but talking of private associations, museums, symphony orchestras, music obviously is less significant in this respect, but all of the major artistic institutions in just about every community. And we're out. We're out, that's all. And I don't know how to get in, because as it happens, the art world, using that phrase in a general way, is a world not at all interested in conservative thinking or in conservative ideals. On the contrary. Now, this is a very serious problem. Again, I don't know what to do about it. I simply point out how, once again, the Tocquevillian forecast has turned against us. And these wonderful private associations for the supporting of museums. Now, in Europe, governments support museums. The situation is not much different there, in fact. Just about identical with ours. But ours, of course, is private, for the most part. And it's supposed to be different. And it's not. Basically, all of these enterprises, all of these institutions are staffed by that group of people that I and others call the new class, people who make a career of in the non-for-profit sector by opposing the profit sector, or at least being congenial to ideas, critical of, or hostile to the private sector, and very happy with the governmental and political sector. The new class is a problem not for conservatism, it's a problem for modern democracies. We have this crazy problem, which, you know, John Adams foresaw. He said he wanted to be interested in politics so that his children, or was it his grandchildren, would be interested in the arts and in philosophy and so on. Unfortunately, his wish came true. And there they are, interested in the arts, interested in philosophy, and utterly hostile to everything John Adams stood for. And this seems to be a natural consequence of Republican affluence, of bourgeois affluence, of capitalist affluence. And again, I really don't know what to do about it. The young people who, incidentally, are the people who are taking, you get fortunes founded by father or grandfather, and by the time the grandchildren come along, your foundation is on its way out as far as conservatives are concerned. And when the great grandchildren come along, it'll be another MacArthur Foundation. I mean, this seems to be the tendency among all conservative foundations. Of course, they own the young in a way that we do not. They offer a scope of activity to the young that we do not. They offer ambitious goals to the young. And yeah, I mean, when I say ambitious goal, I don't mean making money. That's not an ambitious goal for young people, really. We do not. We have a problem of conservative thinking in which young people want to be inspired by something larger than themselves. We have not yet figured out a way to do that. So, all I'm pointing out is that philanthropy these days, which we celebrate in the tradition of Tocqueville and Andrew Carnegie, has turned out to be something quite other than what we expected. And the traditional kind of philanthropy, loyal to the tradition of Tocqueville and Andrew Carnegie, which still exists and is represented at this conference, is fighting a rearguard battle. And regardless of who wins elections, anybody can win an election. All they have to do is screw up and they'll lose and we'll win. But that's not winning, really, because the whole infrastructure remains under their sovereignty. Until we can make a real dent in that, the infrastructure of the culture, of the universities, of the foundation world at large, of all of these institutions that shape the thinking of young people. Until we can do that, we have not done very much, which means that in the years ahead, there will be a lot of work for those of you who are younger than I am to do, which is okay. I would not want to leave you with the job done, I mean, and leave you idle, so I pass on the chore to you. Thank you very much.